Prime Time Replay from Money FM 89.3. Read with Michelle Martin.
Does being rich make us and those around us happy? That is among the questions that my featured read for you today tries to answer. Less self-help, more a manifesto for change. I like the fact that this book helps us think about what it really means to live up to the myth of happy ever after and whether or not that could really be keeping you from creating the life of real purpose. Happy Ever After is the book that we are reading tonight. It's written by Professor of Behavioral Science at LSE, Paul Dolan. It deconstructs the social narratives of what the perfect life is all about and gives us a glimpse of the possibility of reaching beyond the myth of perfection. Paul Dolan is an expert in human behavior and happiness. He's helped governments, charities, even big businesses influence behavior to improve well-being. And he joins me live over the lines to talk about his book, Happy Ever After. Welcome, Paul. You're a best-selling happiness expert. In fact, your first book, Happiness by Design, came to be known as the book that would make you quit your job. I love that. I can't wait to pick that one up. Paul, what were you trying to add to our understanding of happiness in this book?
Wow, what an introduction. I mean, if trying to manage people's expectations makes people happy, I've got a lot to live up to now, haven't I? So ask me again.
So Happiness by Design, your first book, right, made so many people think about what life would be like if they quit their job. What were you trying to add to what we understand about happiness in this book? Happy ever after.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on your show. I realized that, I mean, this is kind of pretty obvious, really, the things that you learn take you quite a while to learn. But there's lots of kind of barriers and obstacles that are in the way of people leading lives that would give them the most pleasure and purpose in their experiences, which is what Happiness by Design was all about. And a lot of those are to do with the social narratives that are constructed for us on our behalf about the lives that we ought to be leading. We feel that we have to live according to the stories that are told to us by our families, by society, by evolution, wherever they come from. And they kind of can get in the way of us living lives that make us happiest. So I try to deconstruct some of those narratives in Happy Ever After. It's more a kind of a sort of manifesto for people to sort of really understand and accept and where they might be different. And importantly, not to judge other people who might live lives that don't conform to what they might otherwise expect them to.
Oh, wow. I love that. I like that. You're a professor of behavioral science at LSE. So I need to ask, to what extent, what do we know about happiness and to what extent is it controllable, you know, within our sense of control?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I'm glad you mentioned LSE, because what I do is I basically look at large data sets that contain various questions about happiness and all the other things that we might find out about people and their lives, and then we look at you know, which things affect how people feel, and it does depend on the way in which we measure happiness, what our conclusions are about what things affect it. But leaving that detail to one side, it's kind of, you know, a lot of the evidence is actually pretty obvious, to be honest with you. It's, you know, if you're, let's take the first part of the book, which deals with narratives around reaching, that's what I call them, that we're sort of seeking ever more wealth, success, education, you know, status, and you can't have enough of it no matter how much you've got. Well, the happiness data suggests actually you can have enough of it, and in fact you might sometimes have too much of it for being optimally happy. So it's definitely worth emphasizing the point that poverty and the lack of social standing makes people miserable. There's no doubt about that. But you don't need very much. Once you get to sort of basic, you know, sort of levels of income, median levels of income, you know, you've kind of got a decent enough job, you kind of, the sort of happiness returns from you know, trying to achieve more and more beyond that become very small, and in fact sometimes become negative, because what you're doing is you're giving up all the other things in life that make you happy, like time spent with people that you enjoy hanging out with, and, you know, using your time wisely generally, to pursue a dream that doesn't actually make you happy once you get there, or even on the, or actually even on the way there.
I want to ask you about overtime. A month ago, Alibaba co-founder and billionaire Jack Ma said he endorses extreme overtime as part of corporate culture. Now, your book talks about overtime and the link with work. It talks about why we work long hours. So what do you think? Is extreme overtime in corporate culture, what does it do to our sense of happiness? I mean, we all know that instinctively, but what do you think of extreme overtime?
Well, so first of all, can I just say that it's like I don't want to prescribe anything to anybody too much, right? Because there's going to be lots of differences across people. And, you know, there will be some people who absolutely lap up working all the hours God sends, you know, to kind of, I don't know, whatever, to achieve more or to actually just have a sense of purpose in their work lives. And great, those people can knock themselves out. But it's the expectation that people, that everybody should be doing that, that really concerns me. And, you know, again, the happiness data suggests that, unsurprisingly, you know, if you work too few hours, that makes you miserable. But working too many hours makes you miserable too. And we sort of get this arms race of a sort of like a kind of showing off, you know, I kind of work 20 hours a day, I work 22 hours, kind of, and it just sort of gets a bit silly, really. People get caught up in the expectation to be like the first one in the office, the last one to leave. And actually, it's about working efficiently, not working more hours, anyway, at least, right? So, you know, people that work, some of the evidence that work more than 50, 60 hours a week are really miserable.
Yeah, you know, I mean, many of our listeners are successful and they're wealthy and very busy, and we often hear a major source of unhappiness is the feeling there's no time to do what they really want. When it came to Happy Ever After and the social narratives that shape our sense of that myth, right, life happy ever after, what were you most interested in bringing to popular awareness?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, the book kind of, I suppose, sort of hopefully sort of drags people into more potentially controversial narratives, I suppose. I mean, the first part of the book is not, you know, the things that we've just been talking about thus far are not surprising, right? I mean, I don't think they will be to most people. You know, kind of, there's a kind of sweet spot of income, status, success, hours worked, all these things that we should be striving ever more for. And we just need to know, kind of, sort of learn when to stop. You know, people keep asking me now, you know, what are you going to do next? Why do I have to do something next? Why can't I just be happy with what I'm doing? Why can't I just be happy with working at the LSE, writing these books? It's like, why has there got to be something beyond that? You know, I mean, you sort of have this expectation that you just have to keep going. Now you've made this much money, don't you want to make that much money? It's like, well, actually, no. And you've sort of looked at, you're not really trusted. And that's what I'm trying to get over. Like, you know, so if people, for example, if you were to take a lower paying job than the one you currently have, you'd have to really justify that. People would think you're a bit mad. You'd have to go into all the reasons why. You know, you might like your colleagues more. You might not have to travel to and from work so, you know, long, and all these other things that would actually make you happier. But you'd have to really validate it. And so I'm trying to get us to be a little bit more circumspect about that, and just to kind of allow, you know, it's not a controversial thing to say that we should just let people live the lives that best suit them. And when I get into the second part of the book, then it kind of gets a bit more into the related, that's the next heading of the three chapters, which is about marriage, monogamy, and children. And, you know, this is a really, I mean, I think this applies to women and men as well, but particularly women. There's this sort of expectation that to be a grown-up, you need to, well, have at least married and probably had children. And if you've done neither of those things, well, you know, you're probably not a grown-up yet, you know, until you've ticked those off the list of things that you need to do in order to be a fully-fledged grown-up. And again, happiness data and health data as well, it's not just happiness, shows that, you know, the sort of healthiest population subgroup of women who have never married and never had kids, in spite of the fact that everyone else says they ought to.
It's so complex, this whole issue of happiness. We think it's so easy. Do you think social media has changed or shaped new narratives for happiness?
Yeah, it's a super question. So as an academic, I'm frustrated that we don't have, I can't give you good, robust causal evidence of the impact on social media on pretty much anything, happiness or the impact of these narratives, because we don't have the randomized controlled trials that would enable me to say something substantive about that. So all I can do is speculate from correlational data and what we think we observe. And I think in terms of the narratives, that, you know, it's possible that the benefits of social media are that it opens your eyes to a world of people that might be different like you, right? So you can find now lots of, you know, odd people like you online. So that can help you break free from some of these narratives. But I think much more powerfully is the counterposing force, which is that it magnifies these narratives. You know, previously when I, you know, spent a lot of money getting married, I'd sort of show that off to the hundreds of guests that came, and I could, you know, affirm my love to my wife with everybody present and show off how much I love her by how much I spend on my wedding. But now I could, now not only is that, can I show it off to people that are there, I can show it off to the rest of the world by posting on Instagram and other sites that enable me to sort of, you know, just show my wealth and show my success and show my love. And so I think social media probably magnifies some of these social narratives in on balance harmful ways.
I love your book, and I want to ask, you've always been curious about what writers leave on the floor, so to speak. So if you're looking at big data, and I understand you looked at the American Time Use Survey.
Correct.
And you found that among your findings, that 40% of students reading English at Cambridge had been diagnosed with depression in 2014. And when you come across something like that, and I'm a reader, so I'm slightly offended by that. Just joking. But, you know, what do you, when you come across sort of baffling statistics, what made it into the book, and what did you decide to leave out?
Oh, do you know that? That is probably the best question I've ever been asked. I've been asked lots of questions about both of my books. So I don't know what didn't make it in. I can tell you what. There's a couple of things that surprised me.
Okay.
In the evidence, I thought divorce would be worse than it is for kids. Right? There's a massive narrative around, you know, if the parents split up, the kids are traumatized. Well, that's true to some large degree, but much better that the couple get out of a confrontational marriage than stay in one just for the sake of the children. So I thought that was quite surprising, I think. Mm. I think the fact that happiness can actually fall at higher levels of income, it wasn't a great shock to me that it might not rise, but the fact that you can actually be actively less happy if you have too much money, that was really interesting. Because I guess I talk about this much more in the first book, it's where your attention is, what you pay attention to, right? So when you're poor, you're paying attention to the fact that you can't pay the bills, that you need to feed your kids, and that makes you miserable. But if you're rich, maybe you're paying attention to, you know, have we got the right investment portfolio? Are we kind of maximizing our assets? And that draws attention to itself, maybe in ways that don't make you happy either. So it's that kind of in that middle ground where you've got enough money to get by, but you're not paying too much attention to trying to accumulate more, is the sort of sweet spot.
It's a book that
I'm trying to think about what makes. Trying to think what didn't make it in. Mm. I'd have to think for more time than I've got available to give you an answer to that question.
Well, that's a happy answer, because hopefully you'll come back then. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure and purpose. Thank you.
He's author Paul Dolan, and I'm reading his terrific book, Happy Ever After. From love to marriage to children to money, health, wealth. It's a book that talks about the stories that we've come to believe is important for happiness. So if you want to escape the power of the myth of perfection and reach for a life worth living, this is the book to get you thinking about that. The book again, Happy Ever After. I'm Michelle Martin.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at MoneyFM893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.